This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, listeners. It's me, Jinx Monsoon, here with some more Hi, Jinx, with me, Jinx Monsoon. Today, my guest, Solomon Giorgio, compares and contrasts his work on SpongeBob SquarePants and Shrill. We also talk about the trials and tribulations of being super tall and super queer, and what it takes to play that long game in the industry. That is Hollywood. All today on Hi, Jinx. So hunker down and sink your teeth in to some new Hi, Jinx.
Forever Dog.
Hello everyone, I'm Jinx Monsoon, and welcome to Hi Jinx, a podcast where I, an internationally tolerated drag superstar, get to interview compelling and fascinating people about how they became who they are and why they do what they do. Today we are joined by comedian, writer, and pretty person, Solomon Giorgio. Hi Solomon.
Hi Jinx.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm just, you know, existing on a Friday night. Or is it Friday day? I don't, whatever time it's decided to be.
Friday day.
Friday day. I'm well. How are you?
I'm decent. Let's talk about your persona. You recently tweeted, "As a middle-aged queer of color, I know I come off as jaded and cynical, but please understand that underneath my icy disposition is a much meaner person." Would you care to comment further on this tweet?
Oh, to be perfectly honest, that's actually probably a fabrication of some sort. I definitely am much nicer in real life. I just don't want people to know that.
Yeah, there's power in the distance you build between people.
It's just, it's a good place to be, especially if you're like sort of, like, especially with a fan base in comedy, like they just get like just in general, any fan base, they just kind of get a little obsessive and sort of think they have more onus to your persona. And I'm just like, no, that's not going to happen.
I feel like I've been doing a lot of soul searching lately when it comes to the commenters online. You know, it's an eternal struggle as a public persona and social media being a necessary evil. You know, I've always struggled with, you know, everyone says don't read the comments, and then here I am scrolling through them, and then the mean ones pop out more than the nice ones, and then I find myself responding to trolls, and then it's playing into what they are attempting to get out of you, you know, a response and some kind of argument that they can then wear as a feather in their cap, you know?
I understand that. And I think I come at it at a different way, because whenever I do get trolls and do get people mean commenting on me, I remind myself that I am better than them in every possible way.
A wonderful mentality.
Like, it's truly, I try to definitely, I feel like I'm always an equal and loving person, but if somebody is going to come for me, a stranger, then I obviously am already better than them. So it's just, you kind of have to play between the two. It's like, yeah, you don't have a right to say that, but also I should also be ready to, I should also not hurt, be so easily hurt. And it's kind of like you have to, it's a dance and it's a constant dance and it's never ending because you're in the public eye and people will say things to you for the rest of your life.
For the rest of your life. You know, it, the only difference is, you know, is now there's a place to see what they're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about, it's not that people are more critical now. It's just that they have a place to voice that criticism.
Oh, yeah.
And that's my big question right now is we've kind of accepted that we've given room to this access to us. And like I said, social media is a necessary evil. But then it's like when people are like, well, you should be prepared for these comments. Well, you should be prepared for people to hate you. It's like, yes. And why are you fighting so hard to have the right to be like, that seems like it's on you. Like if you're fighting hard to maintain a place where you can be an ignorant asshole, then like, I don't really have time for you, you know, like I don't really have time for these justifications for why you're allowed to be a jackass, you know?
Yeah. It's really, it's one of those things where it's like, there's so much art you can consume that doesn't involve me.
Yeah.
There's a whole world of it for you to go and enjoy and never even bother looking at me, seeing me, hearing me do anything. Like, it's like, it's to them, it's just like, it doesn't make sense. It's like, you can avoid any performer. If you like, it is not that difficult unless you're like trying to avoid like a TLC song at CVS. You're gonna that's difficult. I get it, but
absolutely. Do you know? Want to know my mantra? This is my blanket mantra when it comes to the comments, and it's helped me a lot. Every opinion may be valid, but not every opinion is equal. You know, because I might have ideas of what someone should do health-wise. I always use this analogy. If I have a funky mole on my back, I'm going to go to a doctor to get that mole checked out. Because if I go downstairs to the concierge of my hotel I'm at in any given city, that person might have an opinion on the mole on my back, but that doesn't mean that opinion means anything because they're not a doctor who specializes in that. And I think the same thing goes with comedy and with drag. And I see people like, oh, this was bad. And it's like, actually, where's your credentials and your authority on the subject? You know, now I know we've just talked about social media out of nowhere, but let's talk about your career. In case anyone listening doesn't know, you are a writer on the show High Fidelity on Hulu, as well as the show Shrill on Hulu, starring Aidy Bryant. Now, I haven't seen High Fidelity, but I've watched every episode of Shrill. I absolutely love that show. I'm friends with Lindy West, who wrote the source material. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting for me, spending, you know, 12 years living in Seattle, and knowing the references that Lindy is drawing from in Seattle. But the show itself is set in Portland.
Yes.
Which is where I was born and raised and now live once more. So it's this weird balance of like, I know this is referring to Seattle, but my brain starts believing that this happened in Portland. And I'm like, Portland doesn't have that, you know, but it's fun to watch. It's fun to watch.
It sort of shows you the differences between the two cities sometimes, because it is. There's so many similarities and yet so many differences between the two.
Yeah, there's so many amazing performances on Shrill. Not only Aidy Bryant, but of course, John Cameron Mitchell and Patty Harrison really stand out to me as two very strong performers on the show. But really, the whole ensemble is amazing. There's so many wonderful characters being portrayed, and they feel very grounded in real life, even though the situations can sometimes be larger than life. What's the experience been like writing for Shrill?
I wasn't there for the first season. I came in on the second season. We just finished writing on the third season a few months back, third and final. And it's like, I've known Lindy, I probably would say, right when I started comedy, so about like 13 years ago. And so that's like, I was brought in with my knowledge of Seattle and my knowledge of where Lenny's history, and like I was even mentioned in the source material because I was her roommate at one point. So it was sort of fun to be brought into this world, especially when it was established a little bit, and kind of add my own personal insight from my experiences in the Seattle scene, and then kind of also add my personal stories and just have fun with those characters because they're a combination of so many people that I know personally. Yeah. And but also you don't have to follow any strict rules because it's not following an exact autobiography. It's just, yeah, it's a retelling of Lindy's life through a different character and through 80. And 80 and Lindy are two of the most amazing forces of nature that I've ever had. It's like 80 especially is like just the most kind, hardworking, polite, sweet. Like she was working in the writer's room. She was working SNL and on Shrill, as they were both coinciding, and she just, it was like 60-70 hour work week, and just unfazed, not showing any frustration with the fact that she is working 100 hours.
Yeah. Do you, this is kind of a difficult question to ask, and you might not have an answer for it, but it's going to segue into what I'd like to talk to you about next. So okay. I'm going to ask it. Do you feel that because there are fewer opportunities for large women in Hollywood, that you talk about 80 being polite and professional, do you feel like that she has extra pressure on herself to take on that responsibility, to be polite, to be like, you know, this beacon of light, because if she was difficult in any way, those fewer opportunities for someone like her might close up?
I feel that's like, I don't want to speak for her personal experience, mm-hmm, because it's a very, like, I think we just did discuss that, and it's sort of a lot of the elements of the show is kind of discussing the pressure that she has, large women in the world, has to endure, and just kind of, but also like I feel like she has a very strong power about her to, mm-hmm, to hold her own ground. But yeah, I think compromising yourself is just sort of one of the most terrible, obnoxious things in an industry that's run, yeah, by straight cis white men. And that's
and that's why I kind of ask, is because, you know, we see it reflected in the writing and in her performance of the character, that when you are someone from a demographic other than straight cis white male, the pressures on you are higher. I feel like you're given fewer chances to make mistakes because people just have people in the industry, the powers that be, seem to have less patience for someone from a specific demographic than they might for a straight white cis male. And that's what I really love about Shrill, is the diversity in the stories that are being told in Shrill. You have stories of lots of LGBTQ plus representation, as well as queer people of color. There's trans representation in the show, which I was especially kind of excited by, because it was one of those moments where there is a character on the show who is trans, and it only came up kind of in passing conversation. There wasn't an episode about like, here's her coming out as trans, or here's the big deal we're going to make about this person being trans. And I find that kind of de-escalating that conversation and making it more commonplace and more conversational and kind of, what am I trying to say? The fact that it wasn't a huge production about this person's transness, to me, is the next step in representation, where a person can just be who they are on the show and represent this character without having to have the whole three-episode arc about their transness.
Yeah. I think that's also, yeah, that's really important, because like I feel like when, especially with our coming out, like any coming out story, it becomes so the central part of the character, and then they're just downplayed and kind, yes, of just phased out to the side. And Patty's character deserves better than that. And she is such an amazing performer, and the character is so fun to write for. And that was, it's, like it's like in like even like just making it as something that happens in passing is just much it's more fun writing for character
it's
without focusing
life.
Yeah yeah like I don't like the kid no one just walks around just screaming I'm trans over and over and over again.
Exactly. I find that those big overwrought drawn out explanations of people's identity, that's done more for the straight white audience, you know, and when you allow the character to be more true to life, you're saying we're done catering to your ignorance on the situation. And if you're confused by this, maybe go do some research rather than like complaining that the show doesn't explain it or spell it out to you, you know, because it's not, I think we're past the point of having to explain everything to the straight white audience. And now we're creating work that is for us, by us, you know, as queer people
yeah.
from different demographics.
Well, it's assuming that we have no relatability unless we over-explain our existence.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true at all. We're very relatable. There's lots of things that we do because we're human beings that people can relate to. And
yeah.
it should be written that way. I think that's the best way to write any queer character is sort of, is trying to find something else other
yeah.
than the constant trope that we're presented with over and over again. I've only worked in like a handful of rooms, and this is one of like, this is probably my top experience because it was such a space where everyone was attentive and caring and understanding and wanting to, especially like AD was like gung ho about making sure that Fran's character, the character Fran, her roommate, was just like, also just as important and also had her own agency. And it was just so fun to write. That's the thing, is that these characters are absolutely fun to write when you can just get to do whatever you think they would do and actually
yeah.
and tell the stories that of my own experiences, my experiences with other queer people, and it's just to be able to like have that kind of freedom. And like I specifically wrote the episode about her going to her cousin's wedding.
Mm-hmm.
In season two, and that was
fantastic episode.
It made me feel good. It was one of those things where it's almost there's a conversation with her mother in that it was like one of the most cathartic writing experiences of my life. So I cried while writing it.
Oh, absolutely. What I loved about that is that there were moments where it was like 80's character was shocked. You know, like, oh my God, I can't believe you and your mother got into that fight. And she says, that wasn't a fight. That's just how we communicate, you know? And I think that's a really great way. Like, it's an example of coming from different backgrounds means you have different understanding of things. And I think that trauma and trauma is relative, you know, it's relative to your situation. So what may offend a straight white cis female might not offend a queer person of color because they've had to build that yeah. armor throughout their life.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
My mother hasn't been nice to me in 38 years. So I know she loves me, but
I just, you know, congratulations and kudos, because I think this show is such a perfect example of the difference of when something is written by the people that it's for. You know, it's written by people of varying sizes, varying backgrounds, different identities. And it's so obvious these days, I think, to tell the difference between something that was written by us and for
yeah.
us versus something that was written by someone who has a very narrow perspective of what life is like
yeah.
as a queer person within the various rainbows that we represent.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to tell when a straight cis white man is writing
mm-hmm.
a queer story. And I think our community has lost all patience for that.
Sometimes it's also the gay cis white males that push
yeah.
those narratives.
Well, that's very good to point out. Absolutely. Well, was the transition from stand-up comedy to writing pretty natural for you? Have you always been doing both? Was this a shift in your life?
It's sort of because stand-up comedy is something that always happens at night. Like if I was doing stand-up at 2 p.m. during the workday, then I'm not at the right place. I'm not in the right career. But I've always wanted to do stand-up since I was little. Writing just became something that I is naturally a part of stand-up. I sort of just I was always good at writing, but I was never great at presenting what I wrote. And it's like being a little immigrant kid and just trying to figure things out. And so I was never intentionally funny until I was I probably think I was 25 when I got fully committed to comedy. And then I was like, there's no way I'm gonna become successful at this in any way, shape or form. And with writing, I was like, love to have been a TV writer. Furthest away from my mind. I was like, that's an impossible dream. How dare you think that? Then I just stand-up started going really well. I started doing more shows, getting out of town, moving to LA. And once the opportunities started showing up and I was like, oh, okay, I guess. I did all the work to get here. I just never intended it to ever happen.
Yeah. No, I think the best thing you can do for yourself as an aspiring entertainer, whatever form of entertainment, whether it's writing or stand-up or drag or acting, I think the best thing an artist can do is assume they're not going to be successful. Because when you go into it assuming that you're going to absolutely knock it out of the park every time and opportunities are just going to come flooding your way, the heartbreak is so much deeper. And it's I see people get into entertainment for the sole purpose of being famous. And to me, there's no greater perversion of being an artist than to do it for the sole purpose of being famous. I think I started art school when I went to college for acting. I started with the intention of coming out of art school ready to become famous. And through art school, I think the best lesson I learned was what I actually want to be is an effective artist, because fame is whatever without a mission statement, you know?
Yeah. It means it's sort of a consequence. And you have to choose what action you want that consequence to come from. So, yeah.
And I think I see the best examples of detrimental fame with social media presences, YouTubers, these people who kind of got into it for the fame rather than for, you know, the art of it or for the message that they... If you go into it without a mission statement and then you become famous, we're kind of just watching someone be famous for the sake of being famous. And that interests me 0%. I always talk about the double-edged sword of drag becoming popular is that, you know, when I started drag at 15 years old, 18 years ago, drag was not lucrative. Drag didn't make you popular. Drag made you next to undateable, you know? There were a lot of consequences that came with drag, and you stuck to it because you were passionate about it, not because there was a TV show that could make you famous. And while I think it's a true mark of progress that there is a TV show that can make you famous as a drag queen, I think that there is something being missed from not putting in the years of crawling on your hands and knees and dive bars, getting paid in sweaty, crumpled ones, you know, performing for audiences of two people, you know. There's a lot of learning that comes with that. Yeah. And that's where I got my drag education. And I don't see a relative synthesis for that.
Something fell apart.
Just fell apart. Suction cups just came undone. That is the drag gods telling me to stop talking.
It didn't break.
Yeah.
Because no, I recall I was going to drag shows back then in the early aughts. And like I think I remember I feel like I dated a couple of people who just like sort of dabbled in drag, and they just were too afraid to even like be in drag around me. And I'm like, oh yeah. Like this is really an issue. And it was, it's definitely in a bit better place than it is. And I think because of the internet, there are people who can gain more fame very quickly. But I also feel like there are some queens that don't have it together in their first go. So they have to go into those bars. They have to do those two people shows. And I think they're still out there. I think it's still an option. There are definitely shortcuts. There's more shows, but at the end of the day, it's the cream still rises to the top.
That's a really great way of putting it. You know, I used to have some, I used to have mixed feelings because ultimately I'm very aware that I took a shortcut, a huge shortcut. You know, I was on the long, slow, plodding path for my goals. Drag Race provided me a shortcut, but then I kind of pat myself on the back for the years of the...
I don't really think Drag Race is a shortcut.
I mean, it was
a huge you place endeavor. Yourself in the most in nervous, high tension situation, and put on national TV while enduring it. I don't know if that's a shortcut. I would if I was on Drag Race, I would last 5 seconds, and I would
but
be
you
under the table crying.
Years of crawling on your hands and knees, yes, in the dive bars. You know, I always use that term, crawling on my hands and knees, because Chad Michaels, I think, said that once. Chad Michaels, who you know was one of the older contestants, yeah, when she went into Drag Race, and she did two different seasons, and you know, she won All Stars, and it was like Chad Michaels had worked in drag for a couple decades at that point and absolutely remembers the days before drag was popular. And she always brings that up. Like, I crawled on my hands and knees to get to where I am. And I think that education in doing it when it was unpopular is just, I want to know what the new equivalent for that is, you know, because nowadays it's like you get on Instagram, you get a bunch of followers, and you might make it onto Drag Race and then become a famous, yeah, drag queen. But where's your years of, yeah, of working in the dive bars?
Well, I think there's sort of like with stand-up's been going well on for a while. And when I came in, it's still like there was a set road you can follow, to gain certain access to comedy, but it was not, you don't get to maintain your voice. You don't get to maintain your style. You have to sort of like, these are the spaces I can perform in, and I have to sort of compromise the kind of jokes I can do and the material that I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what essentially is going to happen with drag. It's like there are queens that are going to be like, this is my drag style. This is the way I want to do it. And I can't follow this path to do it.
Yeah.
And it's, or they just like, I'll get on the show, but I still want to cultivate my specific brand. And I think that's just, I think it's just what's like, I think it's going to set out like any form of entertainment that gains notoriety and gets bigger and more popular, is that it essentially there's a boom. There was a comedy boom many times, mm-hmm, over, mm-hmm, and now there's a drag boom, and it's gonna fizzle out. And because it's, yeah, that money isn't available for everything. That's the thing. Yeah. That's what's gonna happen, is that money's gonna be like, no more. only people that are amazing will get it. And then the rest of the queens will be like, we have to fight to the death to get to that level. We have to get on our hands and knees on the floor at the bar. And get
at the dive bar, accepting our crumpled, sweaty ones from the two people in the audience. I think that they're, you know, I've learned so much about fan culture that I didn't know. You know, like, I've been a hardcore fan of many things, you know, video games and certain movies and TV shows and stuff. But I'm also, like, older, so I never really like expressed my fangirl side through social media the way that younger people do. And I think one thing I realized is that young fans when they're so obsessed with one thing, like Drag Race, they forget that, like, everything that's happening with drag has happened with everything else before. You know, like, the fact that there was a boom and a fizzle and now, you know, there's counter arguments. And now, like, people have really high expectations for drag and all this stuff. I mean, that happens with every art form that becomes popular. And I think sometimes the fan base of drag, they seem to... think that this is very unique to drag, you know, like that no other art form has ever been through these stages of evolution before.
You know? Well, that's because they weren't at a gay bar in 2003. they were just birth.
Yeah, it used to be the only way you could follow drag was to go to the gay dive bars where drag happened.
No, I
and now
remember,
it's so accessible.
I remember watching you when I was in Seattle, and I think the first time I ever saw you perform was when you opened for Alexis Mateo after season three.
That was such a great
night. At our place.
And I said yes to the gig immediately because, you know... here's the other thing is the ripples of Drag Race do extend out to the community for better or for worse. You know, I think nowadays it's hard for drag not to be influenced by Drag Race in one way or another, because it's either influenced by the fact that you get ideas from it, or you hold yourself to the standards of Drag Race, or you go in the exact opposite direction and say, if you want a show that's not Drag Race, we've got you covered.
Yeah.
But for a local queen, you know, having not yet been on Drag Race, opening for a Drag Race girl was one of the best gigs you could possibly get, you know, because you've got a great, huge audience. And I was local to Seattle, but I felt like very few people knew about me yet. And opening for Alexis Mateo was a big introduction to my own community.
Yeah. Well, it was also like, it was a very weird way to see, because I've been to drag shows before, and it would be like, oh, it's usually hosting the night, whatever the event was really. And the queen was usually secondary to the actual evening itself. It's just, and this was the first time I was like, I'm sitting down. And we're going to sit and watch an entire drag show. And I think that was sort of, that kind of culture was very, like, it very rarely happened in gay bars especially. So it was definitely a nice little revelation to be like, oh, we're going to sit down and enjoy drag.
Yeah.
And not sideline them.
Did you, have you had moments similar to that as a comedian? Have you had moments where you opened for a big name? I don't know as much about the world of stand-up comedy, but I feel like I think drag and stand-up are... Mm-hmm. Drag, stand-up, and porn all have a lot of intersection, you know?
Well, the thing is with drag is very dynamic. Like, it's one of those things where you have to be bad at it to get... an
to
audience
get
to get... Yeah. Well, like, or, like, to even get an audience to boo at you. Like, that's very... Like, it's, like... And with stand-up,
I see what you're saying.
You can tell when, you have to be, like, with stand-up, you have to be really good when you're opening for someone. And you have to, like, there's no training ground when you're opening for bigger names. Like, you have to be at a better place. And so it was like, I was always terrified when I was opening for a bigger name. Like, I was more afraid doing that. I'd rather been at a smaller show than opening for the bigger names in my first few years of comedy, because it was just like, that's just so much anxiety. The nerves were just too much. And and I'm a nervous pooper, and I just really...
you were shitting your brains out?
Yeah. So it was like those gigs were... They definitely like weren't as bad as they were in my head. They were actually pretty great, but it wasn't until after the fact that I'm like, okay, this is fine.
What are some memorable names that you opened for?
Oh God,
we know that I opened for Alexis Mateo. Who was your Alexis Mateo?
My first big names that I opened for, God, I'm trying to remember now because it's been 15 years. Maria Bamford was one, like, the most memorable ones that I've ever had. I opened
she
for her.
She is one of my favorite people on the earth.
She's one of my inspirations, and also one of the kindest, sweetest human beings in the world. Like, she's one of those personas where it's everyone, especially if you're a comedian, she's like, everyone is welcome. You're all my peers. And I'm like, you shouldn't do that. too many of us are questionable and you should throw a lot of us away. But
can I tell you my Maria Bamford anecdote? So I don't know how many years this was into, you know, post Drag Race, but I had at least enough experiences to know that one thing I hate is, you know, you're at the airport, you're moving from one plane to the other, you don't look good, you're probably cranky, and then someone comes up to you and goes, oh, can I get a photo? And you say yes, even though everything inside of you is screaming, how dare you ask me for a photo while I just like woke up from my vodka nap on this flight. And yet when I saw Maria Bamford get off the same flight as me once, I ran after her. I threw all my instincts out of my head and I ran after her because I had been such a longtime fan of hers. And I caught up to her and asked her if we could get a photo together. And she said, yeah, I really have to pee. So if we could just do it as quickly as possible. I snapped the two selfies. I instantly post them. I'm like, I just met one of my idols. And then I think she responded like, oh, I had no idea you were a drag queen. I guess the eyebrowless face didn't give it away. But and then, I don't know, those moments are, it shrinks your world when you get to meet an icon and an idol like that.
It's one of, like, I think that's really one of the fun things, the accessibility to your idols. Once you start doing the thing you love doing, you're like, oh, I get to just hang out with you. Like, you're gonna ask me to do a show for you. This is like, I thought you should just spit on me and throw me away. That's what I was expecting. But here I am, being respected.
It really blows your mind. Yeah. I want to ask specifically, as a comedian and as someone who writes adult comedy, what was it like writing for SpongeBob SquarePants? How did that differ from your usual?
Well, first of all, that job was just I was trying very hard to find a writing job at the time. And I just so happened to live next door to somebody who was an exec at South Park and also became the showrunner for one season of SpongeBob SquarePants, where they're like, we're going to do, because they don't usually do a writer's room. They just do storyboard and then figure out the story from there. So they're like, they want writers. And he just walked up to us one day. He's like, you guys want to write for SpongeBob SquarePants? And we were like, okay, that's how Hollywood works. And so there I was. I had an email from Nick Loading the next day. And that's how I got my first ever writing job, was through just being neighbors with somebody. and it's such a different, animation is a weird, because anything can happen and you have to make every second entertaining, because it's for children. Like, children have short attention span, so it's like, you can't just make him just reach into his pocket. He has to reach into his pocket, stick his head in, look around, there's a whole other world in there, and then he has to stick his head back out. And it's sort of like, anything is possible. So that kind of almost makes like the list of things in your head even bigger of what you can make happen.
But it feels like with animation, what I love about animation as someone who watches, I pretty much exclusively watch cartoons and comedies. You know, I have a hard time dealing with anything that's too dramatic that doesn't involve superpowers, you know?
I have the same affliction. Don't worry about it.
What I love about animation is that you can tell real stories and you can tell stories that matter, but you're not limited to what you can pull off in reality. You know, to pull off fantastical things with live action stuff requires a huge budget, you know? But when you're working with animation, you can say a dragon comes in and burns the place to the ground, And, you know, you just have to draw that, you know. I mean, animation is extremely expensive, don't get me wrong, but you're not limited to the confines of reality. Was that freeing as a writer? Or
it's fun to just sort of be like, anything can happen. But then it's also like, finding out what kids think is funny is always such a very specific thing, because you want to definitely make sure it doesn't go over their head.
Yeah.
And you want to make sure, but you also don't want to make it, you also want to be entertained by it yourself as well. Mm-hmm. And SpongeBob is just, it does that. So that's the kind of like, that was probably as good of a time as I had. I was also the very difficult, because I was just playing within a field of two worlds and making sure I can weave them together. I don't know if I can write for animation again, because it is definitely a lot more possibilities than I can creatively pour out of my head.
I can't imagine creating work for kids, because you know, I certainly didn't get into drag because my sense of humor is family friendly, and it's been this ongoing thing to get used to, that I have a very young fan base now, and lots of that's thanks to social media and accessibility for entertainment these days. But I, you know, when people say like, is this appropriate for kids, Jinx? I want to say, it sure isn't, and I don't know why that's a standard I'm being held up to. It's like, I love that young people enjoy my work, because young people should be exposed to new walks of life as early as possible. You know, the younger you are, that you start realizing that the world is a diverse and multifaceted place, like, the better experience you're going to have as an adult, you know. Also, but at the same time, I don't think it's my responsibility to make sure that, like, everything I do is appropriate for kids, because those kids should have some adults in their life telling them what's not appropriate for them.
Look,
you know?
Their TV comes with a parental control. Their internet comes with a parental control. Whatever they decide to set their life, like, if you don't want to monitor what your kids are watching, that is on you. But I also, as somebody who grew up in a household where I was allowed to watch whatever I wanted, and no one was paying attention, I was fine. Fine.
Same. Like, I watched plenty of things that I shouldn't have. You know, Death Becomes Her was my favorite movie at 6 years old.
That's such a good movie.
I would stand there and put my clothes on backwards so that I could say, my ass! I could see my ass! And that was 6 years old.
I think my father bought me Basic Instinct when I was 11. That's the kind of life that I was allowed to watch whatever. Like, I was, and also they didn't even relegate even like queer material, because they didn't pay attention. Like, I got to see Paris is Burning in 1992, and I don't know how. I'm very glad I got away with it. And like, when like Tu Wong Fu came out on VHS, I was able to rent it as many times as I like. So it was one of those things where I feel like that exposure was healthy for me. It just made me more secure later in life when I needed it to be.
The only time that I that my mother ever tried to stop me from watching something was Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I think she knew, you know, like, she already knew I was queer at that point. And I think she knew that once I saw that movie, I would definitely be a drag queen, you know. She always worried about me being a drag queen, because she worried about my safety. That's the story she says, you know, and I have to accept that at face value. But so we watched Rocky Horror together, and I think she realized halfway through, what the hell was I worried about? This movie's from the 70s, and everything that seems so scandalous in it is just commonplace nowadays, you know.
Yeah, it's a really, it's a very subtle movie. It's not very, the sexualness is not very overt.
Not compared to like what's on TV nowadays. I really admire the work you've done as a comedian and as a writer. Is it safe to assume that throughout quarantine you've focused on writing, and have you been doing digital stand-up shows?
I did a few, and it's honestly, it's not fun to tell a joke to no laughter.
Exactly. It really isn't.
It's not fun to perform and then slowly close your laptop and just stand and there with yourself.
And then where's the dressing room of people full yeah. of like post-show discussions, you know?
That's the thing, is that that's the aftermath. After the show is the fun part. Like it's yeah. the winding down, being with the other, with your peers that have also performed that night, and just talking shit.
Swapping more stories.
Yeah, swapping more stories, making mistakes, complaining about the venue.
those privileges we have as entertainers. You know. I think it's really hard for me to enjoy something unless I have something to pick apart afterwards, you know.
Oh, hands down. Like I want to complain about the sound. I want to complain about the green room. Why do they have only Diet Pepsi? Why wasn't regular Pepsi
what are
not
they
an
trying
option?
To say? Now, as amazing as your career is, let's get to know some of the intimate Solomon Giorgio.
Oh, the intimate Solomon Giorgio. Is she here?
What was coming out like for you?
Coming out for me was it was difficult. I guess I would say it was. I don't think it was that difficult for me because I was very spiteful.
So you couldn't wait to stick it to him.
Like I was so happy to do it to my parents. Like, it's
did
honestly
you wait for like you didn't clean up your room. You're grounded.
Like
so
it was definitely
what? I'm gay. Like, take that.
Like I'm gay. I'm not going to college. Fuck all y'all. I'm leaving this house. And I had I had such a great support network with my friends and my siblings. And I was in Seattle, just in a nice little suburban area that was just like, I had guardians outside of my own parents that sort of gave me the, like, I was comfortable enough in a good enough space to be like, fuck you two, figure out your shit. I'm gone. And honestly, it's been keeping me going since. It might just be spite.
You're actually very attracted to the opposite sex. Yes.
I would date women if my parents weren't so homophobic.
That's really funny. what, if you feel comfortable sharing, what were specific challenges you faced coming out as a queer person of color?
For me, I just have a lot of social anxiety. I always feel like I stick out and take up space sometimes. And I think that's sort of like, especially like in a city like Seattle, and when you're going out for the first time and it's predominantly white space and you just don't feel attractive and no one's sort of making like, and no one's assuring you of your attractiveness because you're not the most dateable person in the scene. It's sort of like it definitely gave me a lot of hangups, and I was definitely frustrated as when I was younger. But I think now it's sort of just like there's sort of especially being a young man, you think so many things are owed to you in my head that I definitely kind of broke apart and kind of pushed away, and I was definitely had issues with masculinity and presenting as femme. And that was also a big issue that I also had to overcome. But I think there's a lot of it was through stand-up, was a better understanding of myself as a queer person and being a better ally within my own community. And just sort of also embracing my own femininity and just kind of breaking away from a lot of the stuff that I put pressure onto myself when I was in my early 20s.
That's, yeah. I've been thinking a lot about lately, you know, you say you came out in Seattle, I came out in Portland. These are relatively safe cities to come out in, you know, and it's a huge privilege to live in a blue bubble, coming out as a queer young person. But then I've been thinking about what effects I've still dealt with, even though I came out in a relatively ideal setting. You know, I was in a safe place. I was surrounded by other queer people my age. I had safe spaces to go to as a young queer person because there was a queer hangout center I went to. There was a queer all ages dance club I went to. I always felt like I had a community. And yet I noticed these things lately. You know, I always knew that I didn't identify as male. There have been times in my life where I've really questioned whether I identify as female, and the answer is always not quite. And it wasn't until my mid-20s that I came out as non-binary and kind of found the missing piece, you know? But I see myself now in this really safe place, in this really confident place with myself, and I still walk down the street with my head down, slouching. I still, like, I have all this back pain because of how I walk in public. And I'm like, why do I walk like this? And I realized that because I've always been visibly queer, I could dress as masculinely as any other person, but the femness shines from within me. I feel like I've always stuck out in a way that attracted negative attention out in public. And my response to that was to try to shrink myself as much as possible. And now I'm actively working against slouching and keeping my head down and allowing myself to take up space in public areas.
Yeah, as you should.
I'm not as scared about sticking out. And if I do stick out and someone has a problem with it, I realize the problem is theirs, not mine. But these things have long-term effects on us, whether we had an ideal coming out or not. Have you noticed any long-term effects or conditioning you're working against these days?
Definitely. I definitely can see, if in the safety of my own home, I gender expression is whatever I choose it to be. But there's always, like, whenever I'm out and about where I have the benefit of being more mask appearing. So that's for, I just kind of don't really, I very, like, there's times where I do definitely, I'm like, is this the most safest place for me to cross my legs or like, and I think that sort of, I've definitely overcome a lot. And I think it's definitely handy just knowing that I'm also like, I feel like I try to be like, you know what? You're a giant. Cause I'm 6'4" and I'm, and like, what is anybody in that space going to do to me? Like, I just, I've been making myself feel small when I'm truly the biggest person in the room. And I need to not do that.
So in an effort to get to know you better, what's your relationship to spirituality?
That's very, I like hearing about things. I don't technically believe in anything. I'm like, if somebody has a crystal, I'd probably be fine with it being told and explained to me. Will I retain the information? Very, very good chance not. and that's, I tend to do that. Like, cause I was raised very, very religious. And so I sort of, all the work that I did to just dismantle that aspect of myself, I kind of was like, it was sort of like a scorched earth procedure. I don't know if anything, I don't think the seeds of spirituality can grow there yet, but they're not denied to exist.
I think I hear you loud and clear. I was raised very casually religious, but what was taught to me was the sense of guilt. You know, I come from a family that were holiday Catholics, and then we also have, you know, like a rich tapestry of heritage that we didn't know about until late in life. You know, I found out about Jewish heritage late in life, and I was like, late, you know, your 20s. so late. But I was like, oh, maybe this is something I should explore. Yeah. And then I was kind of like, it's too late. I don't care about anything now. You know,
I don't care. Yeah. Can't set up shop. The mall's closed. I can't. And that's sort of like, I love learning about things, and I like obtaining as much knowledge as possible from things. But it's just, yeah, I like, it's just, there's, my family's so cruelly logical and rational, and even except for when it came to God, which was very weird. my mom just is like very like, everything has to make sense to her. It has to, if it doesn't, it doesn't, you get it out of her face. But yet religion makes perfect sense to her. And I'm just like, how?
That's a very interesting dichotomy. My environment was very different. Everything was very much based in emotion. And I grew up in a very superstitious household. And I always say that I was raised by a coven of witches who identified as Catholic because to say they were witches was too scary, you know, because of the Catholic influence. What they were doing was focusing on the rituals of Catholicism and the emotional aspects of it. And then in many instances, you know, my mom would say, like, don't practice witchcraft, don't mess with Dungeons and Dragons. And yet she was casting spells and carrying around good luck charms and stuff. And I'm like, I don't get where the logic in all of this is. So I very much nowadays like proudly identify as a witch, but I also deal with the Catholic conditioning mm-hmm. I was raised with.
So you were raised by a witch not to be a witch, and it ended up being a witch.
And yet here I am, very witchy. Do you have a celebrity crush?
I don't really do celebrity crushes. I don't like, I'm very, I like having crushes on people that I see in real life.
But if for the sake of this conversation, if someone were to knock on your door right now, purely, to have sex with you, just show up, have sex with you and leave. Who would you want that person to be?
Well, I have, like, I remember my two crushes, my first two, my celebrity crushes when I was younger. And that was Omri Katz in Hocus Pocus and Jaimin Hansu in the Love Will Never Do Without You video, Janet Jackson. So if either of those two showed up at those, well, no, Omri Katz was a teenager. I don't want to have sex with him. I take
That's
that back.
Something- You know, it's funny about growing old that you never let go of certain passions that you had. But then it's like, you know, I don't want to sleep with current day Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
It's like, so,
but the teenager inside of me still wants to sleep with the teenager Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
If we can both go back in time and get young again. That would be great. But Jaimin Hansu right now, if he walked in, I would have sex with him immediately. He still looks perfectly the same, and maybe even better since I first fell in love with him.
I'm just always down for Pete Davidson, Eric Andre, Andy Samberg. It's funny that all of my biggest crushes are also like kind of goofy doofuses. There's something about the funny nerd personality that does it for me a lot.
Yeah, these are my peers. I want nothing to do with them. I truly, the easiest way to make me stop liking someone is to tell me they're a comedian.
That makes perfect sense. I think there was a time where I wouldn't have considered sleeping with another drag queen just because of the innate sense of competition. Yeah. And I think that seal was broken for me. I had sex with a drag queen in New York, and we met on Grindr, and neither of us told the other one that we were drag queens. And then the next morning, waking up in the daylight and seeing their room for the first time in the light, and it's like there's pictures of them in drag everywhere. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, you're a queen? And they were like, yeah, Jinx, I'm a drag queen. And I was like, you just drag named me. Oh, shit. We totally, you totally knew exactly who I was. And here I thought I was having some anonymous hookup. And lo and behold, and now we're sisters. And now I'm like, well, what's the point in putting any of those restrictions on?
That's the thing, is that it's just become such a sibling aspect to it. Like, it's like, you're, I can't. I can't fuck my brothers. It's not not normal. And it's like, there's not even like, it becomes the competition part of it. Like, it seems like fun, but like when you're doing better than somebody else, it doesn't it's not fun at all. It is it becomes very toxic very quickly.
I feel like you know, we all find our checks and balances with success. I deal with what I call gay jealousy, specifically gay jealousy, not queer jealousy. It's when another person, assigned male at birth, becomes successful, even though I don't identify as male. Another person who was assigned male at birth becoming successful just immediately sparks rage in me, whether I think it's warranted or not. You know, I'm constantly like, I see, especially if they're a pretty boy, especially if they're really pretty, and especially if they get famous doing something that's almost drag but not quite drag, and I'm like, oh, it's because you're pretty, and it's because at the end of the day you take the drag off, and that's how people identify you, and you, everything's just so easy for you because you're so gorgeous. You know?
Yeah, no, I've had that jealousy before. It's just like, you just showed up, didn't you? That's all you had to do. You're at the open mic in 2007 just telling goddamn George Bush jokes to nobody.
George Bush jokes to nobody. Oh, I love that.
But yeah, it's jealousy just happens. It's unavoidable. Yeah. And it's very specific to the more successful you become in your career, because it's like, I'm not even mad at the person at all. I'm just mad at myself for being jealous. Like, you did nothing wrong. That's what's so annoying.
That's what's annoying, is like, just how dare you not fuck up. How dare you be so polite and genuinely nice to be around that people want to give you opportunities.
Yeah, but I also know that if I got that level of success at their age, I would have completely fucked it up in every possible way.
Well, and it's, I don't feel jealous of people who are monsters, because I look at them and I'm like, well, you're a monster. I don't want to, I don't want to have any part of that. But when it's like someone who's genuinely funny, genuinely talented, objectively attractive, and then you hear that they're just a delight to work with, and then you find out they're 10 years younger than you, how do you not fly into pink rage then?
Well, I think it's also just kind of, you also have to remember that you set the groundwork. A lot of us set the groundwork for that sort of accessibility for those kind of talents. So it's essentially it's our work. We're, they're us. We're them.
I do have my mantra for my gay jealousy is, as long as the opportunity is going to someone who deserves it, then I'm not going to be upset. So if I'm up for a role and then that role goes to, say, a trans person of color, then more power to that person. Like, if it goes to another white person and they happen to be cis and masculine presenting and objectively gorgeous, it's easy to be mad at them because it's like, you get everything! You know? But when it goes to a fellow drag queen, you know, I'm always upset when a drag role goes to a non-drag queen. So if a drag role goes to a fellow drag queen, whoever it is, I'm like, more power to you, as long as it's someone from the sisterhood, you know, actually portraying a drag queen on television, because there's enough talented drag queens out there that the roles don't need to be going to a cis pretty boy who's never done drag a day in his life, you know.
It should never ever 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 do that at all. It's really Because it's like, oh, so like that's, because that's kind of cheating. Somebody else is going to do his makeup?
Oh, someone else is going to do your makeup? And you think that drag can be taught to you in an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. It comes with a lifetime of feeling horrible.
You know, like, and also, it's like no one's first experience with a wig should be televised.
Very, very good point. I'm going to ask you one last this question. Just answer from your heart. What is your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, Jump of the Line, Harry Belafonte.
Okay, so that is one of my, it's not my go-to karaoke song, but I put that song, if I don't know what to play, I have a theory about this song, and it has to this day yet to be disproven. I always talk DJs at clubs into playing that song, even if it's not a club that would normally play Jump of the Line. I can talk them into it just so that they can see the social experiment of a conga line will form no matter what the
on no average, matter what somebody the will start a conga line. And it's, I think that's why I love singing it as well, because I've seen conga lines perform. I've seen people who weren't paying attention to karaoke the whole time perk up and look at me. And it's also the only way I can sing is in an accent. Because my actual singing voice is truly a terrible journey for other people to experience.
Well, that's wonderful to know about you. And now I'm going to test that theory. Do you have anything to plug, anything you'd like to promote?
I definitely want people to watch the final season of Shrill. That would make me the happiest person in the world, is everybody watching it to the point that people felt bad for canceling it in the first place.
And where can we find you on social media?
I'm Solomon Giorgio all across the board. Instagram, Twitter. I'm usually saying something completely obnoxious and relevant about race. And
obnoxious and relevant.
I'm a lot meaner online than I am in real life.
I find this to be true. Well, thank you so much, Solomon, for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. You're a very lovely person.
Thank you for having me.
All of you for listening to Hijinks here on the Forever Dog and Moguls of Media Network. My name is Jinx Monsoon, and we have new episodes every Wednesday. So make sure to search for Hijinks on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. You can follow me at The Jinx on Instagram or at Jinx Monsoon everywhere else. That's spelled J-I-N-K-X. You have to use the K because I paid extra for it, and K is very expensive, isn't it, Solomon?
Yes, indeed.
I'll see you next Wednesday for more hijinks.
Forever.
To listen to Hijinks ad-free and one day early, sign up for Forever Dog Plus at foreverdogpodcasts.com/plus. Make sure to follow at Forever Dog Team and at Mom Podcasts on social, and rate and review Hijinks 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hijinks is produced by Forever Dog and Moguls of Media, aka Mom, hosted by me, Jinx Monsoon, produced by Big Dipper, editing and sound design by Will Pitts, executive produced by Willem Belli, Alaska Thunderfuck, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey.